Okay, here we go. Okay, we're on Daf Lamed Dalet Amid Beis. There was a machlokes with the Rabbanan and Rabbi Meir regarding monetary cases, when they had to be concluded. So, just to refresh your memories from last week, so the Rabbanan, who permitted monetary cases to be concluded at night, they needed a special pasuk to say that monetary cases have to be started in the day. So now the Gemara is going to ask, what does Rabbi Meir do with that pasuk that the Rabbanan were using with? So basically, for the next 10 lines or so, till the end of this sugya, the Gemara is going to bring what Rabbi Meir is using with that pasuk. Because he says monetary cases have to be tried during the day, because he makes a comparison between monetary cases and tzaras. So he didn't need the pasuk that the Chachamim used. So what does he use with the pasuk that the Chachamim used? That's what he's going to ask Rabbi Meir. Hi, this pasuk of Biyom Hanchilo Espanov, that the day that he bequeaths to his sons, which the Rabbanan used it in terms of learning about monetary cases, so my Ovid lay. So what does Rabbi Meir use with this? So it gives a whole different drasha. That's from outside the sound, right? Okay, I just want to make sure that I'm not hearing things. It sounds like the plane I was on yesterday.
Propellers?
Hahu mi boile. So that pasuk, the Rebbe Meir will use it for the following. Gemara is going to give one answer. Gemara is going to immediately reject it. And then the Gemara is going to reframe it and say, no, this is what he meant to say. So homi by we need it for this liquid Tani Rabba Bar Chanina Kameda Rav Nachman. Like Rab Chanina Bar Rabba Bar Chanina taught a Brisa, it's a Brisa that Rab Chanina taught before Rav Nachman, which says the following. That very same pasuk, what it says, Vahaya Bayom Hanchilo Espanov, and it shall be on the day that he bequeaths to his sons. He learns from that pasuk. Beyom atomapil nachalos, in the daytime is when you pass down inheritances. Vi atomapil nachalos balayla, but you may not pass down inheritances at night. Now the Gemara looks at that at first blush and wait a minute, what's going on? When does the inheritance pass on? At what point does an inheritance pass? Yeah. Upon death, yeah. Right? Not when the lawyer lets you know what you get, right? It's upon death. So wait a minute. So you're saying that you can bequeath it in the day and not at night. So what is the inherent problem with that? Can you figure out what the... Oh, exactly. Exactly. So Amar Le, so he says, is that what you're meaning to tell me? Amar Le. So now... the Gemara asks, Abaye says to Rabba Bar Barchina and obviously to Rav Meir as well, Amrali, Elamayata will come out now, man de shachiv bi yamama, someone who dies by day, yarsun labaneh, his sons inherit his property. Ay, man de shachiv balayla, somebody dies at night, lo yarsun labaneh, his sons do not inherit his property, that's not possible, only half the people in the world will ever inherit. So that can't mean, did he really mean to say that the bequeathing happens in the day? Is that what he really meant to say? Maybe Dilma, maybe he meant, it's not the question of the actual bequeathing, but maybe what he meant to say is, din nachalos kamarta. Perhaps you meant that the adjudication of inheritance directives takes place by day. Now we're talking about the adjudication of, okay, now we will see, you know, we'll make the determination who gets this and that. Meaning to say, important, that is, if someone gives his inheritance directives during the day, no further court action is needed to execute his will. But if he gives the directives at night, court actions is needed, as Abaye will explain. Okay, you don't understand yet? He's going to explain it. We're going to talk about a person when he's dying, and he's going to give directions when he's dying what he wants to happen with his inheritance. So if he gives directions in the day, finished, done, we don't have to go to court, we don't do anything. But if the directions are given at night, then it just has to be done with a court afterwards. In other words, the directive can be given. You can bequeath it in the night and in the day. But now just to adjudicating it at the courts on that, okay, we're going to just finalize this is happening, has to be in the day. And it can be done even by the person himself. Let's just explain first. We haven't said enough to understand at all what he's saying. Titania, for we're going to learn in a brisa as we get into the detail of what this is. It's a very specific situation. When the Torah talks about inheritances, the Torah concludes that section with the following words. It says, there's another brisa now. So the second brisa is going to clarify what the first brisa is saying. It says, V'hoysa l'bnei Yisrael l'chukas mishpa. This law of inheritance should be to the Jewish people a statute of judgment. And with that ending of that topic, the brisa says, Ora kol ha-parsha kula lios din. The entire section ends, that's kola parsha kula, it is ending what? Ora, to establish inheritance directives as final judgments, and this brisa was applied to this. In other words, the verse indicates that inheritances are conclusive. That is, when a person dies, his will should be executed by the people who heard it exactly as he directed without need for further court action. That's what it means when it says, V'hoysa l'bnei Yisrael l'chukas olam. These laws of inheritance, this is the law. And in other words, you don't even really need to go to a court necessarily. That once the person who's dying says what he wants, that's the law, finished. However, that depends how and when. Okay, and this is what has to be done in the day. B'yom hanchilo, if the person who's dying, the one who's going to bequeath it, he wants to have the legality that it's now been bequeathed. He has to make the directive in the daytime. If not, then there'll be witnesses to what he wanted, and then they have to go to a court who just assigns it, as it were, in the daytime, as it will be as the details are coming out.
But of course, the witnesses that are there could have different views about what he said.
Well, he has to say it clearly. We'll see. We're going to see now. Kid Rabbi Yehuda Amarav, as Rabbi Yehuda Rav said, Damar Yehuda Amarav, the following. Here's the point. The guy's on his deathbed now. So look at the two different scenarios it plays out. Shlosha, if three people, Shenichnasu Lavakar Sechol, they come into visiting a sick person, and the sick person is giving directives for executing his will. Remember, in those days, they didn't have lawyers and all this stuff, and he wrote a whole will and all this stuff. The guy's on his deathbed, and he just tells the three people what he wants, and that's all. And he got three guys there. Now, three guys have an interesting opportunities here. They have two ways that they can behave. Three people can act as a court, that's one, or they can work as witnesses. So let's see which option they pick up, and we'll see what happens. So if there's three people there and he's telling, like, this is my last will and testament, obviously they've all got to underhear it the same way together. So Ratzu, if they want, Kosvim, they can record the directives in a document, sign it as witnesses, and now it's not a court-ordered thing, as it were, but it's just a testimony that this is what he says, that would then further have to go to a court just to... what's the fancy word?
Formalize it,
right? So if they want, they can just write it down and just testify to what the guy said. Ratzu, if they want, Osim Din, they can execute the judgment themselves. If the visitors act merely as witnesses, they have no authority to confer legal significance to the man's dictates. In that case, a court will be required to settle the estate. But if the visitors want, they themselves may act as a court of three judges to execute as well. A court may rule on a case based on their own first-hand information without having heard from other witnesses. In the case under discussion, the person's directives are tantamount to the admission of a debt. They thereby have the status of a valid testimony. The visitors can thus act as judges in accepting this testimony and execute the will. So they got an option. They can just say, okay, we're going to be the judges and we're going to execute the will. And you're going to see in a minute that has to be done in the day. That has to be done in the day. That's going to be the point. But, or if they want, they can act as witnesses. But that's only if three come and are visiting him. But what if Shnaim, what if it's only two people visiting? Now the options are limited to one option. Kosin, all they could do is write down the record of what he said. But ve'ein osim din. They can't execute the judgment. It's got to be judged by a court of three. So these two visitors cannot qualify to judge. Now, here's the point, the final point we have to add to this. This is what Rehuda Marav said. Comes along Rav Chista. From Rav Chista, Rav Chista said, this what Rav Yehuda Barab said, Lo Shanu, this was only taught when? Ela Bayom, only when the visitors heard the directives by day, because then they can act as judges in the day, and then from his own admission in the day, it could be directed, it could be done. And that's the Pasuk, Biyom Hanchilo, on the day that he bequeaths in front of three people who act as a court, and when it's done in the day, then it can be done that way. Avo Balayla, but if he tells three people at night, they can't act as judges because the judges can't rule at night. But doesn't mean he can't bequeath. But what they do is then kosvim. They write down and record it. The ein osin din. But they can't make the judgment themselves because they have limited themselves to only being witnesses. Mishum dahava laho edim, because now they've made themselves witnesses as opposed to judges. And we have another rule that says, ve'ein o ed nasadayin, and a witness cannot become a judge. If they're acting as witnesses, they can't turn around and judge. They can turn around and take it to a court and judge it. So maybe that's what he meant to say when he said this whole thing of biyom hanchilo, the bequeath in the day. You didn't mean to say that when he has to die in the day. Think that's what he meant? Didn't think he meant better to say that they executed in the day, and they can execute his desire if they do it as a court in the day. Maybe that's what he meant. Marley, he answered, "Yep, in yes, hochinami. That's what I meant." So it can be assumed that Reb Meir also uses the verse on that biyom hanchilo. It means the ruling of Rami Bar Chama. So when Rami Bar Chama said his law, they said, do you mean to say that if a guy dies at night, he can't bequeath? No, no, no. Could it be you meant this and this? Yes, that's what I meant. So that comes out. That's where Meir is going to use the pasuk of Biyom Hanchilo, that when a person dies in the day, the witness, the people visit him, can act as the court at that point in the day. And if they don't, well, he obviously, at any time when he dies, his property can be bequeathed, but it has to work through a different function. If at night, for example, then they only can work as witnesses, and then the Beis Din the next day would execute it in the day. And that's what the halacha is saying. Finish, stop, two dots, end of that sugya. We go on to the next little section of the Mishnah that said the following. Dine nefashos donin bayom. It says capital cases are tried and concluded only by day. But as you recall, Gemara is going to later on say, the Mishnah says that's what if only to, vindicate him, to say he's not guilty. If they're going to make him guilty, they have to sleep on it till the next night. But right now they're saying capital cases are tried and concluded by day. Gemara now wants to know the source. That's going to be the next three little sugyas. We're going to do a bunch of little sugyas. It's going to go through each case of the Mishnah, say, what's the biblical source for this? So what's the biblical source? The capital case are tried and concluded only by the day. Minohani, immediately, from where do we hear this? So an interesting case, or even if they're concluded, let me just go back again. But they can only be concluded in the day. You don't conclude it at night. That's the main thing. You never conclude a case at night. So this is going to really be a proof from the case where they execute somebody. So if they try it, even though let's say they try it in the day and they're going to execute them, we know we got to wait till the next day, but you do it the next day and not the following night. In other words, you don't conclude the case at night. If you're going to vindicate the guy, you vindicate him in the day. You're going to if you want to say he's guilty, you'll let it sleep on it. But then the next day, you got to come to the conclusion by the day. That's the point. You got to conclude the case. You don't conclude it by night. Why? Because you're going to see, because we got to kill him right away. In the Jewish courts, you don't give him 3 months. Yeah. You know, that's called cruelty. Yeah. When a person is to die, they say you're going to die. you send the kohen over. Okay, let's do vidui. Admit all your averus. Boom, and you're dead, and they kill you right away.
There's no death row there.
No death row. It's the most silliest thing. Well, I don't know where the secular world came to this idea with death row. I mean, once you've done all the appeals, and you came to the conclusion that the guy's supposed to die, kill him. Finish. What's this idea? He sits for what? What?
Well, the secular world, those appeals can go on back.
No. But when the appeals are done, no, there are people on death row that the appeals are done. And they still let it go for months.
Because they still fear that the judgment is not correct. That's
anyway.
Well, I can petition the president. Take a chance to have to do tshuva for like the next 3 months.
Yeah, they wait for the next president to get elected. Right. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, we don't do this. We don't do this because we believe that the courts are honest and they know what they're doing. Yeah. Anyway, so what's the source? Menani, Mili, where is the source, the biblical source from this? So it's an interesting, there's going to be a few psukim we have to connect together to connect the dots over here. Omar Rav Shimi Bar Chiya, Rav Shimi Bar Chimas, Simi Bar Chimas says, Omar Kra, the Pasuk says the following. This is coming up in a couple weeks in the Chumash. The story of the Baal Peor. If you recall, when the Midianites and the Moabites got the women to seduce the Jewish men to be involved in immorality and idol worship. So then Moshe had to go and clean up the mess. And there were thousands and thousands of men who were doing things wrong, and they had to now convene lots of courts to judge these guys and to get them punished. Okay, that's the story going on over there. So the pasuk that we relate to that says, "Vahoka osam and hang them up, Lashem before Hashem, neged Hashemesh against the sun." In other words, when you executing the capital punishment, it's got to be done in the daytime, right? So, and that's to the people of the Baal Peor. Since executions took place by day, the verdicts also have been handed down that same day, in keeping with the law requiring executions to follow immediately after verdicts, which we'll learn in another page. We're going to learn that idea in the next Amud. So once we know that a verdict must be, the execution must follow the verdict, so what did we say about these guys who were convicted of capital cases? They were hung up by the sun. Before sundown, they had to be hung. That means the case had to be finalized in the day.
Thousands of them in the desert.
What?
Thousands of them.
Yes, unfortunately, it's not a good situation. There's Hashem punished some with a plague, but others had to be formally tried and executed for worshiping idols and doing these affairs. So now, the problem is, it's a strange word. The word that's very strange is the word vahoka. Now, we already told you it means to hang, but it's a very unusual word. The simple Hebrew word is usually v'yitle. Talia is to hang. So now the Gemara just want to know, how do we know? We need to now prove. This is the proof. The proof is done. But now we're going to say, wait a minute. How do you know that word hoka means to hang? That's the next thing they want to know. And that we have to go through a proof now. Amar Rav Chisa, Rav Chisa asks the question, a little digression. Minayin, how do we know lahoka? The word hoka, shitliya, means hanging. Okay, so now we got to go to another story. This is the story with Shol HaMelech. If you recall, let's give you the background over here. Shol HaMelech killed out the city of Kohanim, of the city of Nov. Why? When David HaMelech ran away from Shaul, he was hiding, and he went to the city of Nov, and the city of Nov did not know at the time that David HaMelech was public enemy number one to Shaul, at least. And they gave David HaMelech, come on, I'm hungry, they gave him food, they gave him a little thing to help him out. Then later on, terrible Lashon Hara was said about the city of Nov. I said, look, Nov is helping your enemy, David. So they called the Kohanim and said, were you helping David? He says, yeah, but we didn't know he was, you were having trouble with him. He says, I don't believe it. You guys are traitors. And Shaul gave the order to kill the entire city of Nov. But 80-some Kohanim were all murdered by him. So now, subsequent to that, now the problem is there was collateral damage to that. There were these people, the Givonim, from the times of Yehoshua. Some are going back about close to 400 years ago. There were people who faked out the Yidden. and said they wanted to convert. They dressed up for people from out of town, but they really were Canaanites, and they got the Jews to make a treaty with them and to all those kinds of things. And then Yeshua found out it wasn't right. So Yeshua said, you now we make an edict that you will now be wood choppers and water carriers. And for who specifically? For the Kohanim. Okay, now, that Nov, the city of Kohanim, was destroyed, so the Givonim had no Parnassa. And now, many Givonim died. Okay? Now, subsequent to that happening, in Shaul's time, there was big troubles that were happening not after Shaul's time, in David's time. Now, so you have to put three stories together here. So the Givonim fooled Yehoshua. Yeshua makes some water carriers and wood choppers. Okay, and they're working for that, for the Kohanim. Then 300-400 years later, Shaul kills out the city of Nov. Subsequent to that, Givonim die. Then when David is the king, a great plague comes to the Jews, and David's trying to figure out what's the reason for the plague, and he's told the reason for the plague is because what Shaul did to the Givonim. You got to go to the Givonim and ask them for Mechila, to forgive you. But those Givonim are ruthless, and they made a very terrible demand, and the demand was that they have to bring 7 descendants of Shaul to be hung by the Givonim. That was the only way they would get forgiveness. Okay, so in the context of that story, it uses this unique word of Hoka'a to describe the word hanging. That's all what we want. How do you know the word Hoka'a means hanging? So how do we know it means hanging? Now that I gave you all the context, we could skip all the footnotes at the bottom. It says over there, V'hoka'anum l'Hashem, he will hang them. These are the sons of Shaul, Begivas Shaul, in a place called Givas Shaul, Bechir Hashem, the chosen of Hashem. So you see that it means, and that clearly the context was to hang them. So that's the proof. But also it says another thing. Now, the Gemara now is going to prove, but still we haven't proved anything. Because we don't know, it's how do you prove one word from another word? It's an unusual hoka. So here the word is hoka. So I don't know if it means hang, maybe something else. So now you got to go to the next few psukim that show us that somebody took them down from being hung. So now you know that the word meant to be hung. Uksiv. And then it says, Vatikach, let's look at it, it's easier. Vatikach Ritzpa bas Aya es hasak, and it's written that Ritzpa, the daughter of Aya, took sackcloth, Vatitaheu la al hatsur, and spread it for herself upon the rock, Mitchilas katsir, from the beginning of the harvest. You gotta keep reading, it doesn't bring you the whole thing, until water dropped upon them out of heaven. And she did not allow either the birds of the heaven to rest upon them by day or the beasts of the field by night. So what do we see? We see that the corpses were left hanging on the trees. So she protected the bodies. So that's Pasuk is showing that therefore Hoka meant that they were hung because she was protecting the bodies. It's thus apparent that the retribution exacted by the Givonites included leaving the bodies of Saul's sons exposed to predators and the elements. This indicates that their request in the earlier verse to Hoka, the sons of Shaul, meant to hang their bodies from trees as a public demonstration of their vengeance. We see therefore the term Hoka connotes hanging. You follow that? In other words, she kept them that the predators would not eat them, right? Interesting point. Rashi cites the Gemara that explains why the corpses of Saul's sons were left on the trees. Even though it's generally forbidden to leave a corpse unburied for even a single night, in this case, the public sanctification of God's name superseded that prohibition. For passerbys would learn that even Jews of royal lineage were held accountable for the harm caused to non-Jews who had converted to Judaism. Okay, anyway, but that's the point. So we see from this that it means they were hung. Okay, so what do we see so far? So we have the story of Baal Peor, where the men were sinning, and they had to be judged. And it said what? That they had to be strung up, hokad, before the sun set. And now we proved from the story with Shaul's sons that hokad means to be hung. Okay, we're not done yet. But all we know is we're hanging. But wait a minute, what about any courts? We didn't get any court business. We're just hanging them. But what does it say before that? Uksiv, and it also says before that, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, kach eskol roshei ha'am. Now it says before, at the beginning of the Pasuk, it says, Hashem said to Moshe, take all the chiefs of the people and hokah them before Hashem against the sun. The Gemara's got a little problem with that for a minute. Now, if the word hokah means hang, then the verse seems okay that the chiefs were to be hung? Why would you hang? The chiefs are like the judges, the big ones. So why are you doing that? I was going to explain. See, Gemara asks first, Ima am chat, if the people transgressed and prohibited idolatry, what did the chiefs of the people do? Why should the chiefs be punished for the transgressions of others?
That's right.
This is what he means to say. Hashem said to Moshe, but they didn't divide the chiefs into many courts and then try and execute the people of Baal. So he's saying, take the chiefs, split them up into many courts, and then Vaholka, and then judge and punish them. Thus, Hashem was commanding Moshe to appoint the chiefs as judges who convene many courts. The judges would then try the people who worship the poor idol. Anyone convicted of transgression would be executed. His body would then be hanged, because the punishment for idolatry is execution by stoning, with the victim hanged after he dies.
But not the chiefs.
The chiefs would judge them.
Right.
That's what he's saying. Take the chiefs. Not to hang them, take the chiefs and break them up into many courts. The verse under discussion should therefore be understood as containing two separate clauses. Kach es kol rosh ha'am, take all the chiefs of the people to be judges. Then, v'hoka sam l'Hashem v'hoka sam, those judges shall hang the idolaters before Hashem against the sun. That's the proof. So now, wait a minute. Gemara is saying, why do you need so many courts? Just use one court. Why do you need so many courts? It's a side issue. The proof is done now. The proof we have. We have the proof that, how do you know that you must finish the court case in the day? It's from the story of the Baal Peor, where we see two things. That they were executed before the sun set, and if they're executed before the sun set, must mean they were judged in the day, and the judgment had finished the day, because you execute them right after the judgment. And now we just fall into a side point that we're telling the leaders, the chiefs, to divide up into many groups. Gemara now asks the question, my time, why did they have to have many courts were needed? Why couldn't one court try everyone? Take all 10,000 and put them in front. This is, they've all, we have a testimony in one. So Gemara gives one possible answer that they reject. Elam, maybe you want to say, Mishum She'ain Donim Shnayim Be'yachad. Maybe you're not allowed to judge. There is a law that we will learn later on. You cannot judge one court cannot judge two capital cases in one day. But that's not so in all cases. V'amar Rav Chizr, Rav Chizr qualifies that statement. Lo Shana L'Bishtemis, that's only when there's two different types of capital cases. Two different crimes that need two different cases. What if it's the same crime, a bunch of people?
Okay.
Let's say you see 10 people are doing idol worship together.
That's one case.
So that's one case. Even though it's 10 people, it's one case. Avobamisa achas, but when it's one type of punishment of death, done, and you can judge more than one day. So why do they need so many courts? Look at interesting svara. The reason a court may not judge two capital cases on the same day is to minimize the chance of someone being executed by mistake. An error is likely to occur, though, only if two different types of cases are tried, since much effort is needed to try each case, an error might be made in the process. They have to really think hard. However, if the two cases involve identical transgressions and punishments, no unusual effort is required for the second case. Hence, there's no reason to be concerned about the possibility of error. So therefore, so why do they need so many courts? Just make one. The answer is, it's time. It was too many people had to be judged. There was thousands that had to be judged. Rather, to remove Hashem's burning anger from the Jews. What was going on over there? It said after they executed them, then the burning anger of Hashem went away. So by having everyone, not just one court, involved in avenging God's honor, by bringing the transgressor justice, God would no longer be angry at the Jews. In other words, they wanted to get this done as soon as possible. You still have to hear testimony. That all takes time. And if one court's going to have to wait to hear every single testimony for every single person, it's going to take a long time to get rid of these guys. So therefore, break up into many courts, get rid of God's anger as quick as possible, and take care of them. Okay, good place to stop, right?